This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, March 22, 2012, in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Indigenous leaders and local communities warn of environmental damage after President Obama offers support for the Keystone XL Pipeline's southern section. In Argentina, Catholics protest a Supreme Court decision that allows abortions in the case of rape. And as uprisings and protests continue in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia has been largely ignored. We'll speak to one student who has been part of a local protest in that country. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Military forces in Mali have seized power of the government. FSRN reporter Amadou Tembine is in Bamako. He says the coup happened last night amid a gunfight between mutineers and military loyal to President Amadou Toumani Touré. Touré has now been arrested and Bamako is calm once again, but heavily armed soldiers are still in the streets. Officers in the military made the announcement over state television.
FDF ne vise en aucun cas une confiscation du pouvoir.
We have no intention of confiscating power. We solemnly promise to hand over power to a democratically elected president as soon as national unity in the country's territorial integrity is restored. The country is going through a critical time, so we call upon the people for reconciliation and forgiveness.
The military is angry about the government's handling of a Tuareg rebellion in the northern part of the country. Indigenous protesters in Ecuador have reached Quito, the capital city, after a two-week march across the country. Representatives of Andean and Amazonian nationalities are protesting against the government's new mining and oil projects and for their right to protect the environment. Irena Caselli reports for FSRN.
Representatives of Ecuador's 14 indigenous nationalities reached the outskirts of Quito on Wednesday, wearing their traditional feathers and weapons. In early March, the government signed a $1.4 billion contract to build Ecuador's first large-scale mine. Another billion-dollar mine contract is expected to be signed soon. The government says the projects will create thousands of new jobs. But protesters are worried the mines will pollute their land and rivers. Delfín Tenasaca is one of the organizers.
This is not development, it's counter-development. We don't know where we'll get our water from in our communities. We don't know where we will find things to eat if we destroy our environment.
Government representatives are due to meet protesters on Thursday afternoon. Irene Caselli, FSRN, Quito.
Bill Lee, the police chief of Sanford, Florida, announced today he will temporarily step down from his post, according to state media outlets. This comes after city commissioners last night passed a no-confidence vote for the chief. Lee has defended his department's decision not to arrest George Zimmerman, the man who shot and killed an unarmed black teen who was walking in a gated community. The family of Trayvon Martin and community activists all over the country have called for Zimmerman's arrest. People are mobilizing around the incident.
Trayvon Martin was you.
Yes. Yes.
Trayvon Martin did matter.
Yes.
And I just want New York to know that we're not going to stop until we get justice for Trayvon.
That was Tracy Martin, Trayvon's father. He spoke to activists and the press late yesterday at the so-called Million Hoodie March in New York City. The U.S. Justice Department is reviewing the case. Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant entered uncharted territory today as its operations continued even after its state license expired. The 40-year-old plant has received a 20-year license extension from the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but Vermont's attempts to shut down the plant have landed the state in court with the plant's owner, Entergy Nuclear. Demonstrations marked the end of the plant's legal operation yesterday, and activists began a campaign of direct action today. FSRN's Carl Ettenier has the story.
Well, a federal court decision in January made it more difficult for the state to shut down Vermont Yankee. The nuclear power plant still requires a license from the State Public Service Board to continue operating, a license a plant doesn't have. Activists staged a retirement party Wednesday for the plant that refuses to retire. Deborah Stolaroff, with the Vermont Yankee Decommissioning Alliance, cut and served chocolate retirement cake for the plant.
We're sending it off in good style.
Oh, Yankee, your time is up now. Yankee, your time is up.
Direct action is occurring today, both at the Vermont Yankee site in southern Vermont and at an Entergy office in White Plains, New York, and corporate headquarters in New Orleans. Near the reactor site, demonstrators estimated that 1,000 people had massed by 1 p.m. Carl Ettenayer, FSRN, Montpelier, Vermont.
Cannabis dispensaries have been described as one of the newest sectors of the healthcare industry. Today, Los Angeles dispensary workers announced they are unionizing. FSRN's Lena Nozizwe reports.
The same union that represents grocery store clerks will be representing workers at Los Angeles medical marijuana dispensaries. Mike Shimpok is spokesperson for United Food and Commercial Workers Local 770. He said the union only represents workers employed by legitimate businesses and that dispensaries are no different.
Whether they get their medicine at legitimate legal cannabis dispensaries or some point from a pharmacy, you know, we also represent pharmacists. The dispensaries in one form or another are here to stay.
Shimpok says unionization will bring better training, less turnover, and more stability to this newly minted sector of the healthcare industry. There are as many as 900 medical marijuana dispensaries in L.A. County. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. President Obama gave his blessing to the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline today, which would stretch from Oklahoma to Gulf Coast refineries. But indigenous and environmental groups are protesting, saying the project threatens the air and water, as well as native burial sites. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Standing in front of a huge stack of pipe segments in Cushing, Oklahoma, the president explained how his administration was moving forward on TransCanada's application to start building the southern half of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Today I'm directing my administration to cut through the red tape, break through the bureaucratic hurdles, and make this project a priority. To go ahead and get it done.
When TransCanada first applied to build the more than 1,100-mile project, the president moved to delay the decision until 2013, citing environmental concerns that needed additional study. When Congress passed a bill forcing him to make a decision on the full pipeline within 60 days, he rejected the permit. But in his speech Thursday, President Obama cited the many oil and gas drilling projects he has approved and will approve in the future.
And as long as I'm president, we're going to keep on encouraging oil development and infrastructure, and we're going to do it in a way that protects the health and safety of the American people. We don't have to choose between one or the other. We can do both.
But the hundreds of protesters who gathered in Cushing to oppose the Keystone construction disagreed. Among them was Rosemary Crawford, a Cherokee and Choctaw Native American who has been working to educate Oklahomans about the Keystone Pipeline for the past 2 years.
Our concern as Native Americans, because this pipeline is coming down through our Indian territory, as that we have burial grounds that are not marked and that we are not being allowed to have the list of where those archaeological sites will be destroyed. We also have concerns about the product that's in the pipe, and we would really like to keep that out of our water supply.
Crawford and the other demonstrators were kept about 6 miles from the site of President Obama's address, but say they'll continue to voice their opposition as the project goes forward. TransCanada has also announced its plans to reapply for the northern leg of the pipeline, which needs the State Department's approval to cross the U.S.-Canada border. The company says it will change the pipeline's Nebraska route to avoid environmentally sensitive areas, one of the major concerns that led to the first application's dismissal. But Jane Klebe from the group Bold Nebraska says this won't solve the pipeline's risks to her state.
TransCanada continues to talk about the reroute map, saying they're just going to, quote-unquote, jog around the sandhills about 20 or 30 miles and then continue going down with their current route. So if that's the case, it's still going to cut through the heart of the Ogallala Aquifer. And tar sands, which is the contents of the Keystone XL pipeline, is a more dangerous type of oil.
Minutes after the president's speech, the White House published an executive order expediting the review of the southern leg of the Keystone XL, saying the project could, quote, create jobs, promote American energy production, and ultimately benefit consumers. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The Federal Communications Commission approved a rule this week that will boost the number of low-power radio stations around the country. The decision implements a key provision of the Local Community Radio Act, a law Congress approved in 2010 that removed restrictions on creating more low-power local stations. It took about 10 years of community advocacy to pass the bill, which the corporate broadcast lobby opposed. Monday's decision affects thousands of applications for translators, which repeat programming from large stations usually outside of the community, sometimes far away. Some media corporations apply for dozens of translators to rebroadcast their material, decreasing the diversity of voices on the airwaves. Brandy Doyle is with the Prometheus Radio Project, a group that pushed for passage of the Local Community Radio Act. She said this vote shifts the balance of who dominates the national airwaves.
If the FCC hadn't dismissed all of these applications, then translators would have filled up all the available frequencies that could have gone to local community groups. And so they dismissed them in order to make room for new low-power FM, LPFM stations that can be used for local groups who want to play local news and information, who want to have local music and artists on, and people can use their own airwaves for news that's relevant to their communities.
Following this week's announcement, locally based nonprofit organizations can apply starting this fall to create radio stations that will broadcast 3 to 5 miles in any direction. Doyle says this will especially help outreach and education in marginalized communities.
Consolidation in commercial media ownership has really left most communities with fewer and fewer options for news of any kind, much less a diversity of viewpoints in the news. And it certainly doesn't meet the needs of people who speak languages other than English, for working people, for women. So the chance for us to tell our own stories and be able to use local airwaves for local needs is really important, and not just in getting informed, but in developing solutions to problems on the ground.
Many immigrant rights groups have expressed interest in creating radio stations to spread information and better mobilize their urban communities, including Puente in Arizona, which has been organizing against the anti-immigrant law SB 1070, and the Somali American community in Minneapolis. Last week, the Argentine Supreme Court reached a groundbreaking and unanimous decision that it is not illegal for a woman who has been raped to get an abortion, and she doesn't need prior judicial consent to do so. The decision has both the Argentine Catholic Church and abortion activists hard at work. The church is seeking to overturn the decision, and the abortion activists want to use it as momentum to legalize all abortions. FSRN's Eilish O'Neill reports.
Between 70 and 90% of Argentines identify as Catholic, although a much smaller number, about 2 in 10, practice their religion regularly. One of those is Martin Monedero. He's a lawyer and a member of Frente Joven, Youth Front, a group of young Argentine activists who seek to protect life and family. He says that, as far as he's concerned, the Supreme Court's ruling has legalized abortion in Argentina.
Se puede presentar cualquier mujer.
Any woman can show up at a hospital with a signed declaration without any proof that she has been raped, without accusing anyone in particular, and, with that, she can ask for an abortion and the hospital is obligated to give her one without asking any questions.
The Supreme Court says that they haven't legalized abortion, they've just interpreted Argentine law, which says that abortions are allowed in order to save the mother's life, or in cases of rape. Abortion rights activists say the ruling was a step in the right direction, but that it doesn't go far enough. Manuel Tortizi is a member of Campaña Nacional por el Derecho al Aborto Legal, Seguro y Gratuito, or the National Campaign for the Right to Legal, Safe, and Free Abortions.
Making abortion illegal doesn't eliminate abortion. The only thing it does is make it so some women die or get seriously hurt.
Human Rights Watch calculates that about 500,000 Argentine women get abortions every year. That's more than double the rate in the United States, where abortion is legal. Florencia Lopez, another member of the National Campaign for the Right to Abortions, says that she wants both legal abortions and comprehensive sex ed to be available to all Argentines.
No hay aborto legal, no hay educación sexual.
There's not legal abortion.
There's not sex ed. So women are without the right to express our sexuality freely and safely. There are barriers to the implementation of the comprehensive sex ed law. There are provinces where the Catholic Church has a lot of influence, and it gets in the way of the implementation of sex ed.
Lopez is referring to a law passed 6 years ago by the Argentine Congress that mandates comprehensive sex ed for every student in the country, even those in Catholic schools. Lopez says that part of the reason she's involved in the struggle for sex ed and legal abortion is that at least 100 Argentine women die every year during clandestine abortions.
It's a question of class here. The women that die during abortions are poor women, actually impoverished women, who don't have access to basic economic rights.
Other countries in the region have even more restrictive laws than Argentina. Chile, for example, does not allow abortions under any circumstances, even to save the life of the mother. Anti-abortion advocate Martín Monedero says Argentina could benefit from similar policies.
Chile is the country with the lowest mortality rate from abortions in all of Latin America. Why? Because it has a public health policy of assisting pregnant women, of helping them. That is, a woman that gets pregnant has unlimited resources around her and a strong public health system that helps her find a solution so that she doesn't have to have an abortion.
Monedero says that he's not going to stop working until all abortions are illegal in Argentina. Meanwhile, Florencia Lopez says that each time her campaign presents their project for the legalization of abortion to the Argentine Congress, they do so with more signatures and with more public support. Alicia O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
As protests across the Middle East have gotten headlines, from Egypt to Yemen, Tunisia to Syria, unrest in Saudi Arabia, though on a much smaller scale, has attracted much less attention. That changed earlier this month when dozens of students at King Khalid University in the south of the country were injured as they protested conditions at the school. Protests have also taken place in other cities, according to the Arab Network for Human Rights Information. For more, we're joined by Shaima Al-Mahdi. She's a student from King Khalid University in Aba. She was one of the protesters and is a spokesperson for the female students there. We're reaching her now as she travels in the U.S. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi.
Hi, welcome. Shaima, first begin with telling us, what are your primary concerns or demands as students at the King Khalid University?
The first and most important demand is that the president of King Khalid University has to step down. The other demands are attached to maintenance, buildings, services, and library. Can you imagine that we don't have a library in my college? However, the government has paid billions, but the corruption has diffused in the university.
And Shaima Mahdi, can you give us a little background? Why do you want the president to step down?
First of all, we have been suffering for that day we started studying at King Khalid University. The supervisors deal with us with arrogance and indignantly, seeing that the deanship office has empowered them. The beginning of the problem, we had lived in the middle of West. Then we went to meet the dean, but she refused, and she has never met us. The day after, we received a broadcast from students that says we have to gather and go to the dean, but she closed the doors, and we couldn't reach her. The next day, the supervisors took the girl from her hair because they guessed that she was the leader. However, all of the students objected, and the chaos had been started.
Well, you're starting to describe some of the response from the university to your demands. But before we get into that, yeah, the other concern you mentioned was the facilities at the school. You said you don't have a library there. Is that right?
Yes, we don't have.
So without a library, where do you go to study? Where do you meet to do your studies?
We have to find any library out the campus.
Getting into some of the response from the university there, How has the university responded to these meetings, to your calls for demands? What has the reaction been like?
Prince Faithful, who is the governor of Asia region, has met us, and I represent College of Arts. The next day, he complied.
So he complied to your demands, or he complied to exactly what?
Yes, for all our demands.
And when was that?
The next day.
Oh, okay. The next day, which was last week, is that right?
Yes.
So when do you expect those changes to be available to students, or when do you expect the changes to take place?
As soon as possible, I think.
Now, according to the Arab Network for Human Rights Information, the response from security forces to some student protests has been the death of one female student and the injury of 54 others. Do you know where this took place, and can you confirm that taking place?
Okay, I confirm that no one was killed. And the students who had been injured were just fleeing during the evacuation.
No one was killed. And how many people were injured?
50. Maybe 50 students.
And were there any other arrests? Is there anybody still detained?
No.
Why do you think the prince acquiesced or agreed to your terms, whereas in other places when students ask for changes, it's very difficult to get the changes? What was different about where you were?
I think because he believes that it's our rights, and he declares that.
We've heard reports of protests made at other universities and the response to that, such as the student at the Taiba University in Medina who was reportedly expelled. Do you have any information on that or the activities at other campuses?
I have no idea. However, a couple of universities have joined us to support our demands. Also, they have been suffering from the same reasons.
Shaima Al-Mahdi is a student from King Khalid University in Aba. She was chosen to be a spokesperson for the female students. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and I appreciate that.
In Indian-administered Kashmir, government soldiers have come under increasing scrutiny for human rights violations in their effort to quell an armed uprising in the region. Yet despite cases of killings and disappearances, the government of Indian-administered Kashmir has now admitted that India has not allowed prosecution of any of its troops since they arrived in 1990. FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan has more.
In 1990, the Indian Army and paramilitary began a crackdown in Indian-administered Kashmir to quell a popular armed uprising. Under the immunity provided by Armed Forces Special Powers Act, enacted the same year, the army and paramilitaries allegedly carried out killings of civilians and forced disappearances and rapes. But many have eluded prosecution for their crimes because the Armed Forces Special Powers Act granted Indian troops the power to shoot on suspicion and arrest without a warrant. Survivors and international human rights groups have long criticized the law and called for justice. Officials in Kashmir have requested prosecution in at least 50 cases. However, the Indian government maintains the Armed Forces Act has a built-in provision for checking abuse.
The government admitted for the first time that in 22 years they have failed in acquiring prosecution sanction for any case against the armed forces personnel.
Khurram Parvez is a rights activist who works with the Srinagar-based Jammu Kashmir Coalition of Civil Society.
Earlier, the government used to say that there are mechanisms for protection of human rights even within Armed Forces Special Powers Act. This is what they said in UN in 2008, and this is what they have said to international organizations in the past. But this response actually negates all the claims of Government of India that there is any protection for human rights within Armed Forces Special Powers Act. This response, where they have said that no sanction has been given for any prosecution in Jammu and Kashmir, means that there is 100% impunity for the armed forces operating in Jammu and Kashmir.
The Jammu and Kashmir government's request that Indian Defence and Home Ministries grant permission to prosecute accused troops came after a long drawn-out legal procedure.
If you see, there are thousands and thousands of cases pending in the courts where perpetrators are known. But despite that, Jammu and Kashmir government has only sought sanction in 50 cases only.
Khurram says that problems for victims and survivors start from day one, with police reluctant to file cases against troops. One example is the murder of 17-year-old student Javed Magre in 2003. He was apparently abducted from his home, then killed. The army described him as a militant who had attacked Indian troops patrolling the locality. Ashraf Magre is the victim's uncle.
पुलिस ने जो इन्वेस्टिगेशन की उस एफआईआर की वो बाद में फ्रॉड साबित
The police investigation found the army's report a fraud. A magisterial inquiry also established that Javed was not a militant, but a student, and killed just because the light of his room was on late at night.
इस बुनियाद पर कि लाइट क्यों जल रही है?
In 2007, the state government requested that the defense ministry allow prosecution of the accused personnel. While Magre's case is among the very few where investigations have moved forward locally, Indian officials have taken no action. Others have been fighting to prosecute disappearances. In 2002, Bilkis Manzoor's father, Manzoor Ahmed, was picked up from their home in Srinagar by army men. The family has heard nothing from or about him since.
We are fighting a case in court, and the accused personnel had moved for the Supreme Court to stop the proceedings. The Supreme Court dismissed their application, and we are following the case in the court here.
The Jammu and Kashmir government has yet to request a sanction for prosecution, and Manzoor says she was offered bribes by accused troops to withdraw the case. In recent years, there have been demands from the Kashmir state government for full or partial revocation of Armed Forces Special Powers Act. The army has resisted that and claimed that the erring troops are prosecuted by court martials and internal inquiries. But activists do not agree with that claim. Khurram says they have unsuccessfully sought information from various military and paramilitary forces about the personnel they have themselves prosecuted.
They have said that this information is exempted. They don't want to share this information with us. If they don't share that information with us, why should anyone believe and trust them that they have prosecuted anybody?
Many continue to call for India to revoke the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. But even if it is, Khurram says, that won't be of any help to past victims and survivors of human rights abuses. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.